Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and it's good to see you, Christy.
It's great to see you, too.
I've missed you. I know we've both had some vacation times this week, but we've been both back for a week now, and it's wonderful. We've got some great guests. We got Dr. Jim Mazza coming on today to talk about his new book on integrating narrative medicine and evidence-based medicine, or we call it... I want to call it
combining storytelling and science for better healthcare.
And I'm going to call it back to the future. Is this just what we used to do, and how's it different than what we're doing now? So we got lots of names, and we're really excited by this.
We are excited about this. Dr. Mays is a great guy, so I'm looking forward to talking with him. But first, Adam, we do have some research that matters. We're going to talk about the special formulas that are sort of the fad to try to reduce allergies.
Yes, a lot of people have their children or their grandchildren are on these special formulas, and we're also going to look at autism and some new research that suggests, is it more genetics or is it more in the environment, and what in the environment may be doing it?
Talk about things in your lifestyle that might decrease your risk of sudden cardiac death or heart
dying suddenly,
yes,
right, from heart problems, and then back pain
and massage.
Do you ever have back pain?
I have a lot of shoulder tension.
I get some back pain. It's either case, does massage help?
We'll answer that question.
Well, let's talk about our very first research then about infant formula and allergies. And this is looking at kids who are born, who have a strong family history of allergies, and who are given products that are without soy or without cow's milk in a way to try to reduce the chances that they're going to have allergies.
This was a study done and published in the Journal of Allergy and Clinical Immunology. So they took 620 babies that had, on average, been breastfed for 3.5 months. So they did get the benefits of breastfeeding at least early on.
Could have been longer, but that's okay.
That's right. Who were then given three different types of formula to see if there was any change in their risk of developing allergies long term.
Right. They got this partially hydrolyzed whey formula. And the others got a cow's milk formula. And the third group got the soy milk formula. And then they followed these children out for 2 years to see how many developed allergies and did all kinds of things that I don't even want to describe to you. Pinpricking these small kids seems cruel, but they got obviously IRB approval for it, Institutional Review Board, and to see that unfortunately it didn't result in changes in allergies depending on the group they were in.
Yeah, there really wasn't a lot of significant change.
Half developed allergies in each group, and it didn't matter which type of formula they had.
So they followed like risk on their developing asthma and
no
oversensitivity.
Right? So what did it suggest? So it suggests then that expending more money or changing away from these formulas to try to reduce future allergy use in a group that is at high risk, unfortunately, probably doesn't work.
Yeah, so I mean, underscores the importance of breastfeeding. There were some possible benefits to the whey formula that are worth exploring more. But at this point, I recommend to my patients to continue breastfeeding as long as you can. And then the other choices of formula may not make a difference.
That's right. Well, let's go into our very next research that matters. And this deals with autism. And we're really obvious, everyone is sensitive to autism because it has grown very much in the world here in the United States. In North Carolina, at University of North Carolina, it's one of the centers for teaching and research and education on autism. So a lot of people come to this community to be close to that sort of research. And here we have two new studies out looking at autism.
One of them was from Stanford University, where they looked at twins. And they looked at identical twins who have the same genes and what we call fraternal twins that only share about half of the same genes to see, as you follow them over time, try to tease out how much of developing autism is genetic versus because of the environment.
Right. And both these articles in the Archives of General Psychiatry, if you want to look them up. And the first one about this genetic issues, really found that the rates of autism were not as high just based on the genetics alone, really suggesting that environmental factors are actually perhaps even as, if not more important, a factor in autism, which really pushes us to really look for what are the common things in people's environments that could be predisposing people and maybe ways ultimately we can lower that risk.
Well, and the scary thing at this point is, okay, so we say it's the environment's a big part of it, but what is it? That's scary that we don't know. Is it a virus? Is it something else? And we just don't know what it is, and that's hard.
And they said environmental factors could explain 55% of the cases. And in the second particular study, they actually looked at one particular thing in the environment, and these were along mothers and whether they had taken an antidepressant in the year before delivery. And they found that among that particular group was three times higher if they had taken it, particularly in the first trimester of pregnancy, which, how do you feel about taking, antidepressant drugs in the first trimester of pregnancy? What do you say?
Well, I think these results show this possible, although it is a small, when you really look at the total numbers, a small risk associated with taking those antidepressants in pregnancy. But there are women who need, you really have to balance out the need of a mother or a woman to be able to carry on her life and be able to function with these possible increased risk to the baby. So it's an important conversation for every pregnant woman who suffers from depression to have in full earnest with their doctor to decide that.
If you've had an autistic child, I think we would even be really cautious about and really worked with your provider to at least reduce any possible risk in a second pregnancy. But probably too early to stop anything, I don't think. I don't think I could act too much on this particular study.
Well, and you don't know, was it the depression somehow a factor of the environment?
Yep.
What else was
it?
So,
good point.
Let's talk about our next study, which is about lifestyle affecting you dying suddenly.
Yeah, you may have heard a little bit about this in the Journal of the American Medical Association. You've heard Christy and I talk about great diets like the DASH diet or Mediterranean diets and ways of losing weight and, of course, smoking cessation and exercising regularly as independent ways to improve your health. But this really looks at those combination of things as they affect sudden cardiac death in women, probably an under-recognized cause of death among women.
Well, it's really exciting to me. I mean, I think you and I probably read this and say, okay, that makes sense. But I mean, it's an important message that a Mediterranean-style diet, and we've talked about that before on the show, and we can actually ask our great librarians at the Health Sciences Library to put a link about Mediterranean diet.
Right, the fruits and nuts and vegetables and fish, right?
Uh-huh. Maintaining a healthy weight, mm-hmm. not smoking, and exercising. So four very positive lifestyle choices together.
They reduced a 92% decreased risk of sudden cardiac death.
And that's remarkable.
That's large for a major risk factor among women and men. This is one that's a no-brainer, really.
And there are no drugs. I mean, these are all just things you can do to be healthy.
We're going to prescribe that. We'll write it in big letters. We'll put it on the windows. We'll put it out in the waiting rooms, and we'll put it in the exam rooms when we talk to you. What's our very last research that matters?
This is about massage and chronic back pain. So many people suffer from chronic back pain. And massage is something that, although can be costly, is something that is, got low risk to it.
Not many side effects of massage, and probably less expensive than spending an hour at the doctor or the chiropractor.
And it just feels good.
And it just feels good. And so the question is, does it really work? So you're taking people with chronic low back pain, and they were randomized to actually be in a usual care group, or they had the massage therapy, one of two types of massage therapy, and they were followed for 10 weeks. And it actually showed that they had significant less back pain, used less medication, had less time off from work than the group that didn't have the massage. I was impressed,
except that it worked very well for the first 10 weeks, but as they followed them out at 6 months and then a year, that benefit sort of wore off.
Yeah, so, and people knew that obviously they were getting massage, so whether it was truly the massage that was helping them or the placebo effect, which can be powerful here, but you know what? It seems like for some people, this is really worth considering, and maybe, you know, considering continuing the massage, and maybe ultimately, despite the broken nature of our healthcare system at times, finding ways to pay for it, because you know what? It might actually be better than the narcotics that we're currently paying.
I would completely agree with that, Adam. So we've talked a little bit about massage, maybe in improving chronic back pain for the short term.
The four lifestyles that we want everyone to adopt.
About infant formula, maybe not preventing allergies.
And continued research on environmental factors in autism.
So that concludes the Research That Matters portion of our show. After the break, we'll be talking with Dr. Jim Meza about his book, and we're talking about combining storytelling and science for better health care. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, we will be talking with family physician and author Dr. Jim Meza about combining storytelling and science for better health care. Dr. Meza is actually the father of one of our recent resident graduates from the UNC Department of Family Medicine, a dear man, and just wrote a great book called Integrating Narrative Medicine and Evidence-Based Medicine. So Adam and I are thrilled to have you with us, Dr. Meza.
I'm thrilled to be here.
You know, Dr. Meza, you are a family physician, and so as Christy and I, we feel like we're among brothers and sisters, and but it's not every family physician that decides to write a book, and it's not every family physician that decides to write a book that seeks to combine the what some might call the art and science of medicine. Tell us a little bit about yourself and your background that kind of moved you into this area of wanting to write about areas of medicine?
That's a great question. I have been in practice for a while, and I think one of the most gratifying parts of it is that patients who come to the office are willing to share their story. And I realized somewhere along the line that those stories were really important in terms of making the correct diagnosis or trying to help the patient. And just because I have a habit of lifelong learning and I wanted to learn, I learned some through school, some on my own, and through a lot of reading and listening, I came to a greater appreciation of it. And what I found was, in order to be a better doctor, you really have to be a better listener.
But, you know, this listening aspect, which really is what some would call the art of medicine, or part of that art, though others could say there's a tremendous science behind it, that seems to be something that one would think our grandfathers and grandmothers who are doctors, maybe they did that naturally. Is that something that is part of being a doctor and the culture of it, or is that something that we actually have to learn?
That's a fascinating question. I think it is part of the culture of medicine. But I've asked myself, and I've watched other doctors, what are they listening for? And I teach medical students, and I teach young doctors, and often they're listening for the story of the disease, because that's the way we train them in medical school.
Trying to understand how long have their symptoms been going on, or clues to diagnosis?
Right. They're looking for the diagnosis. And so when earlier you mentioned the art and science, you have to get the diagnosis right, and you have to be listening for that, but that's only half of it. You have to listen for the disease, and then you have to listen for the illness, And the illness is really how it affects, how the disease affects that person in a social environment, in their family, in the way they experience things.
Can you give us an example of when you talk about the illness as well as the disease? What you,
give us
you
the
see
story.
Patients, yeah. What comes to mind? How have those patients? I assume whether it's cancer or heart disease or stress or depression.
This goes back years and years and years when I was quite young, and I'll use myself as an example, but. Right in the middle of my back, I had this large mole, and I knew, because I went to medical school, that it should have been biopsied. And I looked at it, and I said, oh, that thing should be biopsied. But because it was on my back, I forgot about it, and I got busy, and I thought everything else was important. And about a year and a half later, I saw it again, and it had gotten bigger. So then I decided, oh, how could I have been stupid? And I made an appointment with a dermatologist. So the disease was that a skin cancer or not? And I can remember the doctor coming in, didn't say hello to me, walked over, looked at my back and said, yep, I wouldn't be surprised if that wasn't a melanoma. And then he turned around on his heels and walked right out the door. And then the intern came in and didn't say a word, but cut the thing off my back and left. So the disease would be skin cancer. The illness was the next 10 days of me thinking, oh, I should have bought more life insurance. Oh, my goodness, does that mean he thought it was? Skin cancer? No, that's not it. Maybe he thought it wasn't, but if some strange chance it did turn out, he wouldn't be surprised. And I just kept playing that over and over in my head, and I got so worried. I was frantic, and there was nothing I could do about it.
And that plays out. That plays out in patients all the time, where they, what they've said and what you've heard, and then what they haven't said and what you haven't heard.
Right. And so my experiences of that week and a half would be the illness. The disease was whether or not I had skin cancer. And the doctor was interested to make the correct diagnosis, and I would have been really upset if he hadn't. But he missed the fact that the way he said something affected my life. So
when you're combining the storytelling in evidence-based medicine, or a narrative being the patient's experience, how do you frame that? How do we do that, especially considering our medical system that gives us these short appointments and a breakdown of people having real relationships with their doctors?
And we got to type everything in.
We got to type while they're talking.
Yes, those are the challenges, which is part of the reason why I think I saw myself and my colleagues, and I thought, wow, we really do need to remind ourselves. And we talked a little bit about this earlier, but I think this is just naturally every doctor wants to listen, but they're rushed for all these reasons. But I actually think the most important thing is to say hello to the patient and then just let them talk. And if you let them talk without interruption, they will tell you what's bothering them, and they'll give you really good hints about what the diagnosis is. So you get both of them, both the illness and the diagnosis, if you let the patient talk. But what we do, and it has been proven in the research, is either 18 seconds or 26 seconds after the patient starts talking, the doctor interrupts the patient, usually to ask one of those questions to nail down the diagnosis. And the studies show it takes 90 seconds for the patient to tell the story and finish it. And I think if you just sit there and can stay quiet with the doctor for at least 90 seconds, it's a lot more efficient.
Do you wonder if we should carry our little timers to buzz in our pocket so that you won't speak until you get the buzz, and then after 90 seconds, okay, you can interrupt if you have to.
Well, think about it. It's like the doctor and the patient have to be both concerned about the same thing at the same time. And when the patient walks in, they're not going to tell you the most important thing, the first words out of their mouth. Now, I've gotten better as I've gotten older, because now I make a list and this is what I really want to ask the doctor. But I never did that when I was young.
As a patient, you mean?
Yeah, and we don't typically say, you've got 18 seconds to tell us what are the most important things going on with you. And after the end of the 18 seconds, I'm starting to ask you questions. It doesn't work that way. But it does raise a whole host of questions that we're going to need to take a break. But when we come back, Dr. Mays, I think we want to talk about what's different really about today versus the Dr. Marcus Welby days of yesteryear, where people's perceptions were maybe doctors were more like that. What's different about today? And you spend a lot of time in your book and your research and your daily practice trying to integrate something that is very different. And I'd like to, if we can talk about that. So we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll be continuing our conversation about combining storytelling and science with Dr. Jim Mazza. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Jim Mazza about combining storytelling and science for better health care, about really listening to patients and also making the right diagnosis and the benefits and the way to try to combine that. Dr. Mazza, it's exciting to talk with you, because so much of this are just the basic concepts of family medicine, right? It's that biopsychosocial approach of really thinking about the patient in the context of what else is going on and listening to patients. But Adam said before our interview, this is like back to the future, that this is, in many ways, bringing back the values of Dr. Welby and those early doctor relationships that we learn about. What do you think about that? Is this sort of a back to the future, return to the past kind of approach?
I talk a little bit about that in the book, where there's a lot of changes in healthcare. You hear about it on the news. And I'm asking doctors to actually draw on their cultural roots as doctors and healers and start doing what we used to do. I think the thing that's changed is that we have a lot more technology, we have a lot more science, and Dr. Welby could have a pretty good understanding of what's out there. And nowadays, it's just too much information. And so the book is talking about how do you find the right information, how do you make it relevant to the story that the patient just told you, how do you share and talk about that information, and how it affects the choices that the patient wants to make in terms of taking care of their health. And so that process, I think you have to start by listening, but then you also have to be a specialist and a professional, and the patient has come to you because they're asking for help with a problem. And the kind of help that I think doctors should give nowadays is that we should help them understand what the science and what the research actually says and what it means for them.
Yeah, you talk about integrating narrative medicine and evidence-based medicine, the title of your book, And I guess you also talk about that narratives have beginnings, middles, and ends. And at the beginning was our conversation about narrative. It seems like this middle portion that you really are now getting into is this evidence-based medicine and the need for the physician of today to have tremendous command over vast sums of knowledge at their disposal. That's pretty daunting, isn't it?
Well, it is and it isn't. I saw a patient this morning, and she told me whenever she has a symptom, she gets out her iPhone and looks it up. And I had to smile a little bit because maybe a year or 2 years ago, I never used to get that type of response. She still had a question for me, though, because she wanted to understand how that information she found in her iPhone related to the particular problem she came in the office that day. So our patients have access to this information, and doctors, I think, have to learn how to really study the science and decide whether or not it's good science or junk science. And most of my colleagues simply believe it if they see it in print, and I never do until I've convinced myself it's true. So that's the evidence-based part of it.
And the narrative and this the art of combining these two things, you know, you talk about, I know you teach a lot of medical students, and we assume that this is what we all want to do and that we all know how to do is listen to people. But I guess my question for you is that true that our medical students coming in really know how to listen? And
can they integrate this evidence-based medicine with that narrative? Is that
how do you teach it?
Yeah, how do you teach it?
I think medical students can do it. I had an experience where I explained this process just to a medical student on one particular patient, and I asked him to go home and write up a paper, and he did the whole thing just from one thing. But it has to be role modeled, and this is really a call to other doctors to say, look, we gotta remember why we're doctors. And I think I had a colleague once, we used to, it's called Journal Club, for doctors get together and they go over a piece of scientific writing. And one of the famous ones is the New England Journal of Medicine. And we were looking at an article in the New England Journal of Medicine. And after the discussion, he said, you know, Jim, before we started doing this, every time I read one of these articles, I just believed whatever the authors said, and now I don't believe any of it anymore.
So it's gone from one extreme to the other.
Well, and you have to find the happy medium. And the part that you were talking about with the patient is you can use the same piece of scientific writing, and different patients will use it differently depending on their own circumstances. So it's really the job of the doctor to explain what it says, how they came to the conclusion, and you have to explain it in a way the patient can understand it. And then some people choose to take the treatment, some people choose to not take the treatment, but it's really up to them and what they're looking to you for as the doctor is to be there with them as they struggle through this. And
so I've got a patient that has pancreatic cancer, metastatic pancreatic cancer, Dr. Meza. And as they come in to the exam room, there's not only the evidence about what treatments may or may not actually work and how one sees those treatments and the side effects of those treatments, but it then comes into quality of life and advanced care. These seem to me the sorts of things that are key and central to the types of ideas that you would like to see physicians really acquire competency and expertise in dealing with. Is that fair?
Absolutely. Because if you think about that same situation, I've seen different doctors present the evidence and sway the patient one way or the other.
Mm-hmm.
At a previous hospital I worked at, the cancer doctors were notorious for putting every cancer patient on any regimen, even if it only made them survive 10 more days. And no one ever stopped and said, what kind of life are you living these days? What's important to you?
Well, and it speaks to the value of continuity of care, which unfortunately we haven't had time to talk about, and I know we've got to wrap up. But, you know, as three family physicians talking to each other, and we're preaching to the choir, but the value of really knowing patients over time, and I hope as we move, as your concepts spread, and as we move forward with healthcare reform, that we really promote this value of knowing people over time with that relationship, because that gives you the insight to patients' values.
Right. And I think it can be done in one or two office visits, but it also, knowing people over a long period of time, you intuitively know them at a much deeper level. But we have to keep that in mind and constantly remind ourselves that that's what we're striving for in order to do that. That being a doctor is a privilege in our society.
Well, it's also a privilege to have you on Your Health, Dr. Meza. We appreciate you sharing just a snippet of your book, of some of your experiences and wisdom and aspirations for the future. Thank you so much.
You're more than welcome. Thank you.
We've been talking with Dr. Jim Meza, the author of Integrating Narrative Medicine and Evidence-Based Medicine. Where, if people want to take a look at this book, Google your name, Dr. James Meza, M-E-Z-A, and where else could they find it?
If you go to Amazon.com and type in my name, you'll find it. Or
great.
You could go to www.radcliffepublishing.com.
Excellent.
Search on it there.
Thank you again, Dr. Meza, for being with us.
Okay, thank you.
We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes, Adam and I, responding to our listener questions to give you our perspective of the answers.
And you can send us your comments and questions to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we're going to listen to our first question from a listener today about a medication called lisinopril that's used for high blood pressure.
Let's listen.
So, what do you recommend for someone who's developed a cough as a reaction to lisinopril, but also doesn't want to go on diuretics?
Well, that's a question. Thank you so much. It's a question that Christy and I and all of our colleagues in primary care, internists, and family docs get a lot, unfortunately, because it is a common side effect.
So
what's the medicine, Christy, and what's it used for first?
So lisinopril is a medicine for blood pressure, and it's a really good medicine, and it's in the class of medicine called ACE inhibitors.
ACE. Not like the ACE in the deck of cards, but an angiotensin converting enzyme. Big, fancy name for a medicine that lowers blood pressure and helps the kidneys to lower the blood pressure.
It does, and it's a great medicine, but it can cause people to have sort of a dry, ongoing cough, just like sort of annoying little bit of cough. And for some people, that's really, really pestering for them. And so there are other options, and in particular, what occurs to me is there's a medicine called an ARB, which is very similar to the ACE inhibitor.
An angiotensin receptor blockade. So it's a cousin. It's a first cousin. But
it is.
It can still cause a cough, but it has a less chance of causing the cough than the ACE inhibitor.
And it acts so similarly that it is thought to have a similar benefit to your kidneys and benefit to your blood pressure. And there are now some of these ARBs that are generic and cheaper. It used to be they were much more expensive, but there are some choices now.
A good question that I don't know, Christy, the full answer for is, you know, it says that in the literature, 7 to 10% of people who take that ACE inhibitor can develop a cough. In my experience, it's actually much higher. It's 25, 30% of people at least have developed it. So I sometimes wonder, why aren't we using ARB, the ARBs, as our first-line treatment?
Well, most of the data to support ACE is in ACE inhibitors. So
right. We don't have as good of data.
Exactly.
Well, so I would, you know. Christy and I are doing a little shop talk here.
Sorry.
But hopefully your answer is, what can you do instead of it? You can take that ARB. You could also take a beta blocker, which is a different form of medication.
Or and then calcium channel blocker.
There are other ways choices. Other than diuretic. So.
Okay, let's do our very next question
about vitamin D and sun.
We've been hearing a whole lot about vitamin D, and folks may be deficient in vitamin D. We can get it with sun exposure. It's now the summertime, and we're all out, or at least exposed in the sun. But by the same token, we slather ourselves, or we're told to slather ourselves with lots of sunscreen or cover up and protect ourselves from the sun in the summertime. Does that affect our vitamin D levels in some way? Should we be supplementing or have ourselves tested as a result? How should we think about vitamin D needs, particularly in the summer?
It's a really good question. Vitamin D is all over the news, and there's new research all the time showing that perhaps more people are deficient or insufficient than we thought before, and that it is very important. But you do get it from the sun, you get it from your diet, and you can get it from taking a supplement. So the question is, how much do we need to worry about sunscreen?
Yeah, the American Academy of Dermatology, actually, Christy, recommends that people should get an adequate amount of vitamin D, but don't get it necessarily, worry about it from the sun and the sunscreen. You know, get it from a healthy diet, a lot of rich foods and vitamin Ds, fortified foods and fortified milk, even from a supplement. Don't worry about your ultraviolet light exposure. You'll probably get some anyhow from just being, you know, walking in the sun where you're not using your sunscreen and you get it on your hands and your face. You'll get a lot of it that way. So I agree with the American Academy there.
I would agree, too. You don't really realize how much you're getting from the sun. Just walking to the car and back, you're not slapping on the sunscreen. So if you're going to be out in the sun for an extended period of time, do wear your long sleeve shirts, be in the shade, and wear your sunscreen.
And remember, we've already talked about this, but tanning is not a safe alternative. And
No. Don't
think that you're going to get your the risk is far outweighs anything there.
Okay.
What's our very next house call question about a bee sting? Ugh, ouch.
Okay, so my question has to do with bee stings. I have a friend who got stung on her arm recently, and her entire arm swelled up, and she couldn't even really bend her arm. At that point, should she start carrying an EpiPen or start worrying about having a worse reaction next time?
That is such a good question, and for me, my initial reaction, hearing how big her entire arm got from the bee sting, was, maybe she does need an EpiPen in case the next time it was worse, where she had trouble with breathing and the kinds of real severe reactions people can have from a bee sting. But Adam, you did some research about it.
Yeah, you know, it's not so clear that you will have what is called anaphylaxis, or that real problem where you have problems with your breathing or problems with your blood pressure or chest pain, because most people, the great majority, 90% of people who have a large local reaction, which is what this is, have the same response the next time they get stung. So that's the problem. And the epinephrine pen, the EpiPen, really prevents that anaphylaxis. So what you would recommend here is that you actually carry with you perhaps something like oral prednisone and topical prednisone and
Benadryl.
And those are things that you could take at the very first onset of such a sting to prevent that large local reaction.
And hearing that only 5 to 10% will go on to have a worse reaction, that's very reassuring. And you can head that off by taking the Benadryl and prednisone early on. And certainly, if you were to have any sort of breathing symptoms or chest pain, you would want to seek urgent care.
And some people would consider having immunotherapy done if you really wanted to cut down on the risk of this happening completely when you were to have another sting. And you could certainly see an allergy and immunologist to talk about that, because that's really probably the only way you could prevent it, but that's more invasive.
Yeah, I'd try the prednisone and Benadryl first personally, but
and
it's
avoid,
worth the conversation.
And avoid antagonizing those bees.
Yeah.
What's our very last house call?
Hi. So my question is about the current treatment for Lyme's disease. The CDC protocol says that you should be treated with 100 milligrams of doxycycline twice a day for 3 weeks. Some current people in the Lyme's disease research thinks that that dosage should be 200 milligrams twice a day. But doctors going by the CDC protocols are reluctant to prescribe more. And I recently was diagnosed with Lyme's disease, and I've already been on a course of antibiotics for 3 weeks, 100 milligrams twice a day. And when the symptoms came back, what the doctors told me to do was just take that course again. And I'm a little hesitant to just follow that course since it did not work the first time, so the disease doesn't progress. Thank you for looking into my question.
This is another good question, and it'll be difficult for us to do this justice, but it sounds like your question is about a discrepancy over your thoughts or what you've heard about taking a higher dose of doxycycline, the medication for Lyme disease, and about having longer treatment courses. And my first reaction is that if you're concerned about your treatment being appropriate or being what the certain researchers recommend, then I think it's so important for you to talk with the doctor who's prescribed you the medicine and say, you know, I learned this from some research, or I talked to another doctor, and have that conversation so you can understand why he or she recommended the lower dose, and talk about it.
But in this particular case, it sounds like actually you got the right dose. You didn't actually get a lower dose here, so I think, and you got it for 3 weeks, and that's actually the upper limit. It is the right dose, and actually it's, you know, some people say it can be as little as 10 days and up to 21 days. And one of the things is to understand is that treatment failure in terms of truly the organism isn't resistant to the doxycycline. There hasn't been resistance described to the primary antibiotics. And this particular drug, doxycycline, is just as well absorbed orally as it is getting it intravenously. So this is a high dose. It's twice the dose we would normally give, and for almost two times what a lot of people would give. So that's why it's exceedingly rare to have treatment failures, and almost to the place where it's usually the wrong diagnosis if you still have some symptoms.
And some people will go on, there have been some studies looking at people who continue to have symptoms after they've been treated with the standard dose of Lyme disease. And the people who were just observed compared with the people who were treated with extended courses another whole course of doxycycline didn't have any differences in outcomes. And that was a well-designed study.
Yeah. And so, you know, it's not unusual for some people to have persistent symptoms for sometimes weeks or months after treatment. But these, again, almost always go away after 6 months, and they're not due to the ongoing Lyme disease. And there is what's called this post-Lyme disease symptoms, and that may be what you are experiencing. And while we would like to think that given more antibiotics, higher doses, longer periods of time is going to have an impact, just as Christy said, lots of research shows it really does not, unfortunately.
That's a really tough one, and I'm sorry we've gone through a lot of studies quickly, but do talk with your doctor about your concerns and have a chance to have that conversation face-to-face.
Yeah.
So we talked a little bit about Lyme disease, about
vitamin,
bee stings.
About what?
Bee stings.
Bee stings. Ouch. Vitamin D, and don't worry so much about not getting enough from sun exposure. Certainly lots of other ways.
And also about blood pressure medicines that cause cough, like ACE inhibitors.
Yep. Well, you know, thank you for joining us, sharing your questions with us on House Calls. And that's going to conclude what we can do with your health today. But you can send us your own comments, yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us on Twitter, on Facebook, and go to yourhealthradio.org. And hear more of our great interviews with our guests.
We want to thank the staff of WCHL, the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Jim Mazza. We hope you'll come back next time for Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
We'll see you again next week. Bye-bye.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360, WCHL.